On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. David Lester explains why he's doubtful about claims of near-death experience.
And I don't feel we have to explain Raymond Moody's classic description of the near-death experience, because we're not sure that that is what people are experiencing. He said it, that's what it is. Other people have said, oh, I had one like that, but other people have said, oh, I had a different one. So we're not even sure what we have to explain yet.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading thinkers, researchers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by someone who's achieved recognition as a leading authority on suicide and is also the author of many books, including Is There Life After Death? An Examination of the Empirical Evidence. He's executive director of the Center for the Study of Suicide and professor of psychology at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey. Dr. David Lester, welcome to Skeptico.
Oh, hi. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. You know, I thought you might start by giving us a little bit of background on your experience and, in particular, the path that led you to your work in suicide prevention and then, in turn, to your interest in NDEs and the whole issue of survival of consciousness.
Okay. Well, I'm an academic psychologist. I don't do therapy. I don't see patients. I'm a professor, and I love to do research, and I love to write. How I got into the field is, a lot of people get into the field because of personal experiences. Mine was just serendipity. I happened to be in the library one day, and I picked up a book called Clues to Suicide, and was really impressed by it. And then when I was given a choice at Brandeis University in Massachusetts of what would you like to do for your dissertation? I said, suicide. And as I say, it just fascinated me from the beginning. Even though I had no relatives, no loved ones who've been suicidal at the time, just fascinated me. And I've 40 years later, I'm still interested in particularly suicide, but also murder, the fear of death, anything to do with death just fascinates me. But as I say, I am a researcher. I am an academic. It doesn't come from personal experiences, and it doesn't come from, talking to clients in therapy.
Well, I think it really is. The issue of death is so overlooked as an area of research in our society that I think it's wonderful that people do look into it. And I was a little bit of your readings. It's very, very interesting, and you're immediately drawn into the personal side of it. I mean, it touches all of us, and yet we all kind of want to look away and not really examine it too deeply.
When I started, it was called a taboo topic. Books were written with, taboo topic in the title. Mm-hmm. We could talk about sex and violence and murder, but, suicide and other aspects of death, people really didn't want to talk about. I think there were more than like a handful of psychologists in the 1960s working in the field.
Mm-hmm. And what about your interest in looking into survival of consciousness and near-death experience?
Well, I'd come across the work on it tangentially, and actually I'm an atheist. Maybe there is this nagging doubt, and since I am an academic psychologist, I thought, there are all these scholarly papers written. Let me look at them and see if they can convince me that there might be a life after death, since I don't believe that there is one.
Okay, it's me again. I don't normally do this, and my apologies to Dr. Lester, but I have to jump in here and make a couple points. Anytime you ask someone a scientific question and they respond with, I'm an atheist, it's a tip-off that they're a certain kind of atheist. They're what I'd call a scientism atheist. There's two kinds of atheists, I think. One is the secular atheist, kind of the Sam Harris atheist, who is really responding to all the trouble that religion has caused our society and has caused individuals, and they get quite agitated about that. And I can get quite agitated about that, too, and that's a natural reaction. But the other kind of atheism is an interesting kind of atheism. And it's the scientism atheism. And I think that's the response here. I didn't bring up that I'm a Mormon or a Catholic or whatever, which I'm none of those. We're talking about a scientific topic, and Dr. Lester says I'm an atheist. This reminds me of the quote that we heard from from Neil Grossman, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, the scientistic scientism and the fundamentalist religious person have something in common, and that's that they take the existence of God as a matter of faith. So here Dr. Lesser is saying, I believe. It's not a scientific position. There really isn't any room in science for atheism. Atheism is a religion. It's a belief. The scientist says, from the data that I see so far, this is our best and most convincing theory. So I just want to point that out.
And so I started reading the research. And of course, once I read the research, I have to write an article or write a book on it. So I finally put it all together into this book, Is There Life After Death? And I say my main point was to see if the research was convincing.
Right, and I think you found the research on the whole unconvincing of the argument.
Yes. I mean, on the whole, I didn't find it convincing, and we can talk about like what aspects of it. But one thing I think I should note, especially for the near-death experience research, which is one of the major, bodies of research that's relevant to whether there is life after death. There are lots and lots of critics, and I thought they were even worse. I thought that the critics did an even worse job trying to convince us that the research was invalid as indicating life after death than the people who do the research trying to convince us that it is. Mm-hmm. So to be fair, the critics did even worse scholarly research than the believers in it.
So it, both sides were unconvincing.
Both sides were unconvincing, yes.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit. What do you think is going on when we talk about near-death experience? Because obviously this is an experience that people have. It's how we interpret what's going on in that experience. What is your take?
Well, that's jumping too far ahead. First of all, I think we don't really know what the experience is. Most of the researchers who study near-death experiences get reports from a sort of an unselected group of people. And in psychological research, you're supposed to have a reasonably random sample or an approximation thereof. And they're also reporting experiences sometimes from 20, 30, 40 years in the past. And as psychologists, we know that, memory is easily amenable to distortion. So that what I remember about my ordinary life 40 years ago is not necessarily what I remembered at the time, immediately after the event. And so it's interesting that there are a few researchers who do try and survey, like, for example, every heart attack patient, that goes through their cardiac unit.
Right, the more prospective studies.
Yes, and so we're getting an immediate report within the 24 hours after they had an experience. They don't publish in the thanatology journals, in the Journal of Near-Death Studies, for example. They publish obscure reports in medical journals that many people haven't read who are interested in near-death experiences. And they very rarely find near-death experiences. I mean, they don't find them that often, in fact.
Well, isn't the percentage, I think, about 10 to 15, maybe up to 20% of people who have cardiac arrest. Now, so 20% of the people are having this near-death experience. And
yes, I've just opened the book at one page. There's a study by Lawrence in 1995, 100 patients. These patients have just been unconscious. I think he said 23% had near-death experiences, which is actually a little higher.
Okay, I wanted to jump in here again because as I listen back to this interview, we kind of get off of this topic and I never come back and talk about it in any more depth. There's a couple points to be made. Dr. Lester here is referring to some of the early near-death experience research, which was survey research, going out and talking to people, sometimes long time after they've had a near-death experience, to try and figure out what are the elements. And a lot of this work was done by Dr. Raymond Moody. But, really, all that is way in the past. I mean, the modern-day research that's being done in near-death experience is much more rigorous, but it builds upon that. I mean, that's just early research, so I'm not really sure where he's going with that. In a minute, you'll hear me talk about some of the new research that's going on, which is prospective. So what they do is they go into a hospital and they get the patients. All the patients in the hospital are monitored, for example, for cardiac arrest because it's such a severe, instant kind of near-death experience that's going to require resuscitation. So those patients are tracked, and immediately within 24 hours after they recover, they're interviewed And what's found is that their experience with a near-death experience is very consistent, which was found in the earlier study. So I think he's kind of missing the point there. Also, it should be pointed out that only 10 to 20% of people experience near-death after cardiac arrest. And that, of course, really doesn't tell us anything about the near-death experience. We don't know if those people were close to death and that's why they didn't have it. We don't know any of the possible reasons why they didn't have the near-death experience. So it's almost like studying the negative of the equation. And I don't know why skeptics focus on the fact that only 20% of these people in the hospital that have cardiac arrest have near-death experience. I just don't think that that really means anything. Interestingly enough, if you really look into the data, what the data shows is that people who do wind up dying within 30 days after having a near-death experience following a cardiac arrest in the hospital are much more likely to have a near-death experience. If you really are close to dying, you're much more likely to have a near-death experience. So that's the kind of data that if you're really looking to kind of establish this, I think you'd be drawn to. And if you're looking for a way to dismiss all this data, then you kind of just say, hey, 80% of people don't have it, so therefore it must not be real, I guess. I don't really know where he's going with that. Okay, back to the interview.
Although, you know, they do note, or he does note, that two patients saw the Grim Reaper, which is not part of the typical near-death experience. So they had some kind of, so a quarter of them had some kind of near-death experience, but not necessarily the one that back in the old days, you know, Raymond Moody described.
Right.
Now, there are very, you know, as I say, and the people who do those studies don't do much more with them. They just report the incidents. They don't even code the reports systematically and sort of do counts of which elements. But, you know, that's the kind of research that we need. We don't want reports of what you remember from 40 years ago or 20 years ago. We want reports of what happened in the last 24 hours.
Right. But isn't it true? I mean, my read of like the von Lommel report that's published in The Lancet, which is obviously one of the best studies. Mm-hmm. It's obviously a very highly respected journal. And it's a rather extensive piece of work. I mean, 344 cardiac arrest patients in 10 hospitals, a long follow-up after. I mean, two things jump out at me. One is that it's supportive of the retrospective studies that are done before, and that the follow-ups show that the memories, obviously memories can change, but in this case, the memories really didn't change that much between the group that in the prospective study and the other groups that had done it in the retrospective studies. But moreover, I think, you know, aren't they really trying to answer the question of what's going on here, and is it one of the two major things? Is it the last gasp of a dying brain? Is it a brain that's just shutting down? Or is it the fear of death? And my read of that is that both of those notions are pretty convincingly, back to convincing, pretty convincingly put aside with these studies and the other prospective studies that are done.
Yeah. But, you know, there are further problems, too. One of the other problems is, you know, that most people... Many people now know vaguely about the near-death experience. It's been reasonably popularized and written about in magazines and so on. You know, and that could easily shape the experience. One of the things that the literature shows very clearly is that the reports of near-death experiences vary greatly from culture to culture. Now, the people who publish those papers often say, oh, look, the reports are quite similar. But when you read them... they're very different. And so we also have to take into account that the culture may shape the way you interpret the experience that you have, let's say, you know, as you are close to dying. I mean, in the book I quote, if we have the time here, a report from India. And this is from Paz Richer and Stevenson, who say, four black messengers came and held me. I asked, where are you taking me? They took me and seated me near the god. My body had become very small. There was an old lady sitting there. And it goes on and on. And typically in India, you know, they look in the book and they say, wait a minute, you're the wrong person. Take him back. Now, you know, this is a near-death experience that's completely different from the kind that they report, you know, in Western cultures. And that does suggest that, you know, the knowledge and the information in the culture shapes the experience. So it's as if, you know, it's, I guess my best guess, and I couldn't prove this, it's like a dream. And just as dreams can be shaped by the culture, you know, the interpretation of this experience you have as you get close to death is shaped by the culture and maybe, you know, what other people have reported. Now, you know, if the experience differs from culture to culture, what we need to find out is, like, what aspects are invariant with respect to the culture? I mean, the near-death experience should be the same for people regardless of which culture they're in. And there may be some elements that are the same in every culture. Those are the ones we should focus on, and there are some elements that differ.
Yeah, but I guess I'd jump in there and say, I mean, now it seems like you're kind of jumping ahead of the story a little bit in that.
Okay.
The real question for me is, if I come into this field, and I'm not an expert at all on near-death experience and have really right. kind of just been drawn into it, because it seems like we're not addressing the fundamental issue of what is this experience. I mean, before we study the similarities, and also because you could go into so many different aspects of it, right? There's the cross-cultural aspect of it. There's the how the near-death experience is brought on, the out-of-body experience. So if I just kind of focus on the best research, and I'm going to take the Lancet study, and I'm going to say, okay, first of all, why do they study cardiac arrest patients? Well, they study cardiac arrest patients because, as we know, within 11 seconds of your heart stopping, your brain goes flat. Put an EEG to. So this experience that we acknowledge is happening, where is it happening? Is it happening before the person's brain goes dead or mm-hmm. after their brain is recovered? And in either case, how do we explain the complex kind of mental functioning that's going on happening in that time?
Yeah, you see, but to my mind, you've jumped ahead. You know, I don't, and also I don't know that research could ever answer that question. You know, all we can do really is describe the phenomenon accurately, test some hypotheses about it, like the effect of culture or the effect of the anesthesia or the effect of having a fever, those kinds of things. The interpretation in the end, that's probably never going to be testable. Let me give you a parallel example. You know, when I study suicide, we can do all kinds of research about risk factors and so on. And when you come down to the individual person, they still say, yeah, but why did my son kill himself? I mean, yes, we know that he was depressed, and yet he was this, and he had this risk factor, but why did he do it? And, you know, we can't often answer the question that the researchers can't answer the question that the layperson wants answered. We can only answer very limited questions. You know, we could look at the effect of, let's say, having a fever on the near-death experience. The implications of that, different people would draw different implications from whatever we find.
But when we talk about it from a biological standpoint, I mean, you've looked into this, what is your best guess as to when this experience is happening?
When is it happening? Well, yes, but I mean, this is just my opinion, and it's like non-testable. I think it's a dream that we have. As before the brain flatlines, it's a sort of a set of neural experiences.
So in that 11 seconds between when the heart stops and the brain stops, in that 11 seconds is when you think the total experience
yes.
happens.
Yes, yes, that's my guess. Now, you know, my heart has stopped several times, and I was very disappointed. That I never had any experience whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how long I was out. My heart actually stopped beating, I think, for 60 seconds at one point. In one of the occasions, I had no experience. But it seems to me there are some experiences that occur then, you know, that are sort of like the experiences we have when we're sleeping. And then we put an interpretation on them. But there would be no way of testing that. Psychological research, or I'm a psychologist, remember, not a physiologist. That's not the kind of issue we can answer. Or we can address. We can only address much more limited issues. That the rest becomes speculation. But I would still come back. You know, I still want to come back even before you wanted to speculate about that. You have to work out what it is you have to explain. I mean, you know, and I don't feel we have to explain Raymond Moody's classic description of the near-death experience because we're not sure that that is what people are experiencing. He said it. That's what it is. Other people have said, oh, I had one like that. But other people have said, oh, I had a different one. So we're not even sure what we have to explain yet.
Okay, I have to jump in one more time. You know, since this interview, I actually went and looked up some of the cross-cultural work that he's referring to, because I wasn't really sure what the status that is. He's not quite right. Really, the latest research suggests there are a lot more of them than we originally thought. And again, it's a matter of what cases you look at. You know, we had Dr. Robert Almeter on a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to provide a link in the show notes to a critique he did of Dr. Lester's work. And one of his main criticisms was that Dr. Lester seems to always rely on the worst possible data and the worst possible cases for near-death experience. Now, you just can't do research like that. What you have to do is take, if someone is a proponent, if someone is making their case, then you have to rely on the best cases, not someone who's done faulty work or even who's just maybe did earlier work that was misguided. We don't know where those reports that he's referring from, those very old reports from the Indians, that the people from India who experienced a different kind of near-death experience. We don't have the same kind of rigor about how they were collected or the means that they were used or the circumstances under which the person experienced that. So we're really relying on very, very poor data that we wouldn't include to make the case for near-death experience. So it really isn't appropriate to turn around that data and then say, well, this is somehow a case against the near-death experience. Moreover, on this issue of we don't understand the experience or if there is an experience, that I just don't think is borne out in the data. I don't think anyone on either side of this issue would really say that there is no experience. Everyone acknowledges there's an experience and that from the means that we have of measuring it, which are pretty standard means in terms of interviewing people and getting their accounts, we have this experience and we know that this experience happens in a certain percent of the population when they come close to death. So again, I just had to jump in there with another comment.
Even with these speculations about when it occurs and so on. So, you know, in a sense, we're jumping the gun. We haven't described the phenomenon yet properly in order that we know what we have to explain. You know, you're mentioning this study by Van Lommel in The Lancet. You know, only 18% of the people had an experience. Well, one obvious question is, why do some people have it and why do some not have it? What is the difference between them? Now, that's the kind of thing that we as researchers can explore. And unfortunately, it's a study that's very curious by Kenneth Ring on that. You know, he did a study of people who report near-death experiences and people who report alien abductions, you know, that they've been abducted by aliens and then sent back onto Earth. And he compared them with a control group and found that the near-death experience people were very similar to the alien abduction people and very different from people who'd had neither experience. But that's the kind of research we want. Why I say it's kind of unsettling research is it's unsettling to find out that the near-death experiences were very similar to the people who reported alien abductions. It sort of said, oh, well, what's really going on here?
Sure.
For example, he found that both groups had had a higher incidence of sexual and physical abuse in childhood, mm-hmm. that they both had dissociative experiences, which is a sort of a psychiatric condition. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of question that we can answer as researchers and might give us some clues, some information. What kinds of people have the experience? What kinds of people don't?
Right.
But that won't answer your question
well,
as to if there is an experience, when does it occur and why does it occur? That kind of question, I'm not sure, is answerable.
Right. I don't know. I'll get off the physiological part of it. It's just, again, in that 11 seconds, we really don't have any good models for how those
right.
kind of complex functioning of the brain could happen and those kind of transformative experiences could happen in that 11 seconds. But
right.
I'll leave that alone for a minute because, you know, the other aspect of it, and I want to talk about more than near-death experience, but we might not
right.
because it's a very interesting topic.
Yes,
and you make
yes.
some good points. But the other point is that
transformative aspect to it. And, you know, I was wondering, I'm sure you're familiar with some of the work that Bruce Grayson's done, and in particular, the work that he's done with suicide survivors who have had near-death experiences. So as a psychologist, if we look at this experience as a very transformative experience and something that we really can't map to dreams being that transformative or anything else really that we know of being that transformative, what do you make of the fact that in Dr. Bruce Grayson's research, people who have attempted suicide and have failed and have had a near-death experience are dramatically less likely to try suicide again, and that they tell them that I'm not afraid of life, I'm not afraid of death, and I want to live, and all these other things?
Yes. Well, that's a hard question for me to answer. because again, you know, I remember I'm an academic researcher, and so I need research on it.
Well, he's published that research. He's
Yes, I know, but I mean, what proportion? You know, we need a large sample, and what proportion had a positive experience afterwards, and what proportion had a negative, and then again, we go into what's the differences between them. I think, well, I'm not sure what to make of that. You know, even to speculate, it may be that going through a near-death experience changes your attitude towards death and dying. You know, and maybe you have less fear of death afterwards, and so that's one thing that the actual experience may have, and that may change your attitudes towards life and death. It actually doesn't really make sense to me that those who attempt suicide and have a near-death experience don't feel suicidal afterwards. I would expect that if the experience is that pleasant, they might be more prone.
But that's not what the data shows.
I know that. So it's counterintuitive to me. So in order to, when you ask me to sort of say, well, why do you think it might happen? It's like, gee, I really don't know, because I would have thought the opposite would happen. You know, the problem that religions have always had is if they describe the afterlife as so pleasant, then they have to prevent their believers from committing suicide to have, you know, to get to this really pleasant afterlife. And so they typically make it a sin in order to prevent people, you know, like, why live this horrible life on earth if there's this wonderful life afterwards? So they have to make, you know, suicide a sin so that people won't do it in order to hasten their death. So it is counterintuitive to me. So I know that research, and it surprises me. I mean, I report it in my book. I don't know what to make of it. I have no idea, except as I, and in fact, you know, if it reduces their fear of death, because death seems less unpleasant, then I say, intuitively, that would suggest that they might do it again in order to continue the experience next time and find out what's beyond the light and so on. So no, I have no explanation for that. To me, it's counterintuitive. I wouldn't expect it at all.
Okay.
But then I would go back and say, you know, you said, for example, dreams aren't transformative. People have a lot of a variety of experiences, including dreams that do transform their life. I mean, you know, we typically think of, you know, maybe the average dream is not that transformative, but, you know, Carl Jung in his analytic psychology, dreams are seen as messages from the collective unconscious to the conscious mind, and they can have especially with the right kind of analyst to help you interpret the dream, can have a transformative experience on you. But then ordinary life experiences can too. So it's not surprising that a near-death experience might change people's attitude towards life.
Sure, but I mean, I think we also have studies now at this point where they've done follow-up research 1, 2, 3, even 5 years after, and seen the effect and we can measure it from a psychological standpoint. And I'm not aware of any kind of corollary experience. It seems highly, highly, much more significant in the incidence of near-death experiences having this kind of transformative quality to people's lives across a variety of dimensions than anything else. I just think this is data when you kind of come around and say, well, I don't know, and maybe it's this, and maybe it's a lot of things. I just think when you look at the data in the whole, we need more of an explanation for what's going on here. But,
as I say, that there are lots of questions that researchers, you know, can't answer. But let me also say, you know, if you read the research, you know, thoroughly, and I'm sure you know this, some people report very negative near-death experiences that are full of anxiety and fear. but not the typical near-death experience. They are not uncommon. Some people report, some reports say they're quite common. And again, we typically don't follow those people up. Of all the people who've had different types of near-death experience, what's the impact on them? And it might well be that people who have a negative experience, it's not transformative in the same way. It might be. So we're following up a selected group.
No, I mean, I think everyone's followed up. I think it's a statistical, at least the studies that I've read. I mean, the Lancet study, for example, has an 8-year follow-up, and everyone is followed up, even the people who don't report the near-death experience. And that's just the cumulative effect of the statistics suggest that it's transformative in this way. And obviously, I think my reading of it is you're right. There are some negative near-death experiences, but they're very, very low on a percentage basis of the overall. I think in the Lancet studies, there were two out of 50.
Yeah.
But, before we spend all our time and all of your time, which is very valuable, talking about near-death experience, I want to talk about a couple other things regarding this whole survival of consciousness issue, and a couple that I don't think always make it into the discussion and I think are just interesting intellectually.
Okay.
And the next is the whole issue of reincarnation, the work of Ian Stevenson and his colleagues at the late Ian Stevenson, who just passed away this year the University of Virginia. What do you make of that research?
Well, it's one of the best body. I mean, it's a wonderful body of research. Thousands of reports, all kinds of statistical analyses that he's done on it. There are problems with it. First of all, he didn't get some good researchers involved with it who could have helped direct the way he should have done the research. And for example, one of the best examples of that is a report of a woman called Gretchen who shows xenoglossy. She speaks in a language that she never was in contact with, and he writes this report up as it's a reincarnation experience of a previous life where she spoke German. And a psycholinguist commented on his paper and said, no, you just didn't do the research properly. This is how you should have done it. What he needed to have done, or what somebody needs to do in the future, is get together with a person like that and say, okay, let's plan the research beforehand and overcome some of the problems we had. So there are often methodological problems in his studies. On the other hand, as I say, the data is so rich, some of the findings that he finds about, birthmarks, and so on, and phobias and so on, they really give us something that we just sort of say, well, this appears to be a valid phenomenon, that people have birthmarks on the place where they remember a previous reincarnation being killed, like if they were stabbed in a previous life, they have some mark on their body in this new life. Those kinds of phenomena are really intriguing, and they seem to stand up statistically. We have the same problem with the reincarnation reports, though, and that is that they're culturally determined, that they differ from culture to culture. Like some cultures, the people are born, they're reincarnated from someone who was a member of their family in the past. In other cultures, it's always an unrelated person. So again, there are aspects of the reincarnation reports, that vary from culture to culture. And that's, again, one of the things that I was disturbed by in terms of trying to be convinced. I feel that the reincarnation experience shouldn't be culturally determined. It should be universal for all humans. So, again, what we'd have to do is look at a whole selection of reports, work out what parts are common to all cultures, and those are the ones we have to focus on. Because that means, that's really part of maybe a real reincarnation report, and some of these cultural differences, well, those we can rule out and say, well, that's culturally determined. The culture determines that people grow up in the culture and know what other people have reported as reincarnation reports, and so model their experience on that.
I was with you there for a minute, and then I think I lost you, because here's what I stumble on is, if there is this large body of work which we both agree is compelling in some of the data that it brings forward, and it challenges our basic idea of consciousness being purely a function of what's happening inside our brain, because we don't have any other mechanism for explaining how this information and this physical form could transform, then isn't that really the issue? I mean, isn't that the lead of the story? Aren't we bearing the lead when we say, well, there's some of these problems and we could tighten it up this way or we could analyze it this way? To me, the question just screams out is, what's going on with, do we have a dualistic idea of consciousness or not?
Yes. I'm amused because either the things that you're interested in and the questions you ask are really interesting questions, but, you know, I don't know that research can ever answer those questions. That's the sad thing. Let me just mention two interesting things, I think.
Sure.
First of all, when you compare the near-death experiences and the reincarnation reports, the reincarnation reports never remember about the life between incarnations. There's always a memory gap there. You remember the previous life, but you don't remember anything about the life, the existence between lives. Whereas the near-death experience is talking about some of the experience, perhaps, that may occur between the incarnations. And it's kind of intriguing that the people who have reincarnation experiences do not remember that. They don't remember, for example, when they died the previous time. And was there a tunnel, and was there a light, and was there, you know, the things that the near-death people report. And I think that's kind of intriguing and a puzzle, because you would think, I mean, the near-death experiences are reporting between existence experiences. Why don't the reincarnation reports also remember that? And, you know, and the people who believe in reincarnation have great difficulty explaining that gap in memory, why there is no memory of the existence between lives. There's no rationale for that, especially, as I say, since the near-death experiences are reporting the first part of that experience. So that's a kind of a really interesting intellectual puzzle, I think, that the two sets of reports don't go together nicely. It is as if they're separate phenomenon, whereas they're both relevant to, is there life after death?
Well, I think the larger question, I'd ask this because maybe we're dancing around it. What do you make of consciousness? Is consciousness reducible 100% to brain functioning, or is it irreducible to brain functioning?
100% reducible to brain functioning. That's a question, you know, that I never address. You know, I'm a psychologist, so I actually don't worry about the brain too much. And I don't like genetic theories, and I don't like physiological theories of human behavior, because in a way it seems to me that, you know, that the psychological aspects are much more complex than our knowledge of the physiology. So I've never really thought about that issue, I have to admit, about what I think about consciousness.
But isn't that the fundamental issue with all this stuff? I mean, is there life after death? I can see that maybe I'm stumbling around here because I'm really surprised at what you said, that you hadn't considered that. And to me, it's kind of the fundamental issue of, we have this paradigm that really isn't friendly to exploring the whole issue of consciousness and to digging into doing all that research, which is so interesting. What happens between lives? What happens during that near-death experience? All that stuff is on the other side of this paradigm that says, no, your experience, your life experience is reducible to your brain, and any theory that violates that is taboo and can't be explored. So I guess I'm still amazed that isn't kind of more of a central, I don't know, interest.
Well, you know, since I don't believe in life after death, I do believe that when my brain ceases to function, then my experience will cease to function. So I would have to say that I do think experience is, no brain, no experience. And I don't believe that anything survives after, no consciousness, no experience, no existence, no self survives after my brain is dead.
Okay.
I mean, I guess I'd have to say that. But on the other hand, you know, I don't tend to consider that issue or those kinds of issues because, you know, in psychiatry or, you know, the physiological psychologists, they want to reduce everything just to, neurotransmission and neuroscientific. Whereas, you know, as a psychologist, I'm interested in the unconscious. I'm interested in speculating about psychodynamics. I love psychoanalysis and Freud's theory. So in my explorations of human behavior, I tend to focus on the psychological aspects and not the physiological aspects. But, you know, I would have to say that my belief is that when my brain dies, when my brain stops functioning, then I will no longer have any experiences. But that's just a personal opinion. Other people would have a different opinion. And I don't know that we can ever resolve that with research. It seems to me that will always be a statement of belief and not one that's open to empirical investigation.
Hmm. I think these kind of investigations are just what's needed. And I really, really strongly have to disagree. I think you've made some wonderful contributions. But the biggest point that I would disagree was just that last part. I think we can definitely probe into empirically using the best methods of science to explore that question of whether or not consciousness is reducible. And I think that the near-death experience really challenges that notion. And I think the research of Ian Stevenson, reincarnation, which you acknowledge has a lot of meat to the bones there when you really
dig into it,
also challenges that notion that there can be no transmission of information from one self to another without the brain. And that's where I keep running into and have a problem with.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the moment I'm working on a slightly different topic. I'm trying to work on a theory of personality, you know, to rival maybe Freud's, although it never will rival Freud's or any of the other people. And I've just published an article and I'm working on a book. And I just wrote an article in which I talk about reincarnation and say, my theory is based on the idea is that we have not just one unified self, but various sub-selves.
Huh.
You can look at them as different, like the happy you and the depressed you, or you can think about the different roles you have. And one of the things I've suggested is that a reincarnation experience is simply another sub-self of yours. It's just, you know, but one that you, it's a bit like a multiple personality. You know, It's a person, it's an aspect of yourself. We can call them sub-selves or sub-personalities. In multiple personalities, you have amnesia, perhaps, for the other personality. In maybe reincarnation, it's really an aspect of yourself that you embody in some story, but it's really part of you. And there's the same sort of dissociation or amnesia or sort of distancing that you have in multiple personality. So in that case, I would be reducing reincarnation reports to a phenomenon similar to multiple personality.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore getting away from whether it's evidence for life after death or not, of just saying, no, it's a completely different phenomenon. That's sort of draw a different analogy.
Well, that's an interesting theory.
Yes, it didn't. Yeah, but it, you know, it could be. There's a report about the hallucinations that schizophrenics have by a guy called Wilfred Van Dusen, and schizophrenics often believe that they're in communication with another order of beings, that they're getting communications from another world. And Van Dusen says, you know, is that possible? And he says, maybe. How do we ever know? How can we ever know? That's not something that's open to research again.
Right.
Maybe we believe it's the voices they hear come from their own mind. It's like from another sub-self. They think it's coming from spirits in another world. He actually says maybe they're the same thing. They're different ways of describing the same phenomenon, although they do seem very different to me. I'm not sure that we can ever distinguish between those. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you do. You have hope that some psychologist or researcher will come along and say, yes, I've got evidence to support one hypothesis rather than the other. But I'm more of a pessimist.
I'm not quite as optimistic about some of those experiences. And that's why I think researchers have to be very careful in the cases they study if they're really going to provide us a window into this. And that's why I think I like and I focus on the research that I think is really kind of trying to pinpoint the phenomena. The problem sometimes is that research, unless you really dig into it, isn't all that interesting. I mean, we go back to the von Lommel research that I think critics, skeptics, and Michael Shermer, I think, was somewhat guilty of that, even though he does a wonderful job generally, kind of misinterpret the research and say, hey, look, only 20% of people have near-death experiences, so it must not really be an experience. And then the researcher comes back and goes, no, I mean, what this really shows is we studied people beforehand to see if they had a fear of death, and that didn't correlate. And we studied whether or not they could be resuscitated and whether they could recall it versus the control group. And yeah, they recalled it a lot better, and we have no way of explaining it. And so the really good studies, I think, require a lot more depth of analysis than some of the more sensational studies.
Yes. And I think there'll be more of that research coming out. You know, Bruce Grayson, I've looked at some of the grants that he's put in to fund some research, and it looks like it's going to be very good research when it appears. I hope it gets funded. Because, you know, by now he introduces the appropriate research methodology, the way the research should be done. And I suspect in the next 10 years we'll see some much better research on the phenomenon, which will give us a sort of a better grasp of what's going on and what it is we have to explain. I say what's the real phenomenon and what's just sort of the peripheral, superficial stuff that we can sort of say, no, then that's not part of it.
Right.
That's culturally determined, or that's determined by whether it's a heart attack or, you know, a brain concussion, you know, those kinds of things.
Right. Now, Dr. Lester, is this a topic and an area that you're going to continue to kind of pursue? Is it really your work going to lead you back more to looking at suicide and suicide prevention?
It's hard to predict what I do. I go off on whatever interest. I remain really fascinated by death, and I still do research on different aspects of it, like the fear of death and suicide and murder. At the moment, I just send in a paper on suicide in serial killers and so on. I am getting more interested in can I devise a theory of personality that's different from any other psychological theorist in the past? And I'm not sure that I'll do that, that I will be successful. It's hard for me. I'm not able to do research on life, on near-death experiences or reincarnation. I don't have the access to the data here. I don't work in a hospital.
Right.
So it's unlikely that I'll do any research on it myself. Whereas suicide, I can still do research. I have access to... at the moment, people are sending me diaries that suicidal people have written before they killed themselves, and so I'm doing diary analyses. I do research on suicide notes and suicidal ideation. There, I do have access to materials, but I don't. If I worked in a hospital, I would have access to patients, and then I could do the research more easily. So no, I probably won't come back to it.
Probably won't come. Well, it's very interesting work, your previous work, and we certainly commend your work on suicide and just shedding more light on these topics that really shouldn't be taboo topics. So thank you very much for joining us today. Are there any points that maybe we didn't talk about that you'd like to kind of finish with?
No, I don't think so. I had sort of made some notes in my book about what topics we should cover, and we've covered actually the majority of them. I just think maybe it's worthwhile mentioning, that there are other phenomena that other people think are relevant to whether there's life after death, and I did refer to them briefly in my book. Things like apparitions of the dead,
sure,
deathbed visions, possession, mediums who communicate with the dead, and poltergeists. And the problem with those is there's even less research. And there would be more to write about mediums, but the problem with mediums is that, there have been so many fraudulent cases in the past that it also becomes difficult to tease out from past cases which are fraudulent and which are genuine.
Sure.
And I guess I am puzzled by the fact that, there aren't that many recent cases of many of these phenomena. For example, if we go back to reincarnation, it struck me that even with Stevenson and his collaborators, especially in India and Sri Lanka and so on, they're always going to a person who reports a previous existence sometime afterwards. They hear about a case and go to it. And it intrigued me that none of the researchers, especially in India, have had somebody in their own family who's had one, a child who says, I had a previous life. They've never been there right from the beginning. I didn't find one case in Stevenson in which the researcher was there from the beginning, from the moment that the child first reported it.
We know so little. I mean, that goes back to our kind of point is we just know so little about what's going on. And
yes,
and
but whether
it's your model eventually that prevails or my model, and my model being that consciousness is interdependent and interlinked among people, or your model that consciousness is totally within inside your brain, either one of those requires just a lot more work to figure out what could possibly be going on and how it really works.
But it strikes me, you know, that Paz Richa, who worked with Stevenson a lot, is like, gee, why didn't one of his children or grandchildren have a report that he could have been there from the beginning? And with the mediums, it does also strike me that so many of the cases they still write about are cases from 50, 100 years ago. There aren't that many current cases that they study.
Well, there is the work of Gary Schwartz. I think has been a very careful and competent researcher that has some pretty striking evidence.
Right, but I did want to mention, you know, there are other sources of evidence that people produce as evidence for life after death, and I didn't address them in detail because I didn't think the research was as well conducted as those on near-death experiences and reincarnation.
Right, I think there is a lot out there. What do you think of Diane Archangel? Work on afterlife encounters. I mean, here's a person who's a hospice worker, very, very well qualified, and along with other hospice workers, has collected thousands, tens of thousands of stories, case studies of folks who've had these kind of experiences.
Yes. I don't know her research that well. I did cite one of her articles, but I'm not familiar with her research that I could really comment on it, actually.
You've been very generous with your time, and thanks again. And
it's been a pleasure talking with you.
All right, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Okay, that's our interview for today. Thanks again to Dr. David Lester for joining us today. I'll have a link up in the show notes to his book. My little extra comments there, which I've never done before, but I guess I felt were needed this time, I hope didn't distract from the interview too much. And for those of you who've signed up for opensourcescience.net and have decided to join us on the replication of the Rupert Sheldrick dogs that know when their owners are coming home experiment, we're glad to have you on board. We are actively now pursuing dogs, super dogs that know when their owners are coming home. So if you haven't signed up and you would like to join in that effort, it's very, very interesting work. And it's really going to, I think, help us move some research forward in a real concrete way and in a web-enabled way where we can all see and all share in the experience and see what's really going on with at least one little phenomena that we can nail down. So if you haven't yet joined us, jump on over to opensourcescience.net and check out what we're doing there. And stay with us on Skeptico, where we'll be back next week or maybe the following week with another interview on controversial science from both a critical perspective and a proponent perspective. Thanks for joining us. Bye for now. Yeah.